Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, Peter, I first interviewed you 7 years ago, which feels like a different historical era, frankly. Quite a lot has happened since then. But I remember, I think I started that by asking your views, kind of to sketch your opinions on the preeminent politicians at the time. That was still David Cameron and George Osborne. Let's start with Boris Johnson. I'm interested in your thoughts on his... We'll start with his moral character.
I don't think he claimed to have one. I have met him a bit. When he was there as a spectator, we got together in a sort of prank against Michael Portillo, which involved me putting myself forward for the Conservative nomination for Kensington and Chelsea. It was fundamentally his idea. I played along with it, published a book. He was an enjoyable person to deal with. I find it, I wouldn't say impossible to dislike it, but I've never disliked him personally. And it's hard to disapprove morally of somebody who doesn't share your morals. I just don't think he does. So in almost all moral discussions, the older I get, the more I say, my main moral concern is about myself. The whole point of morality is not to tell other people what to do, but to get some kind of control over yourself and over the things that you oughtn't to do that you perhaps like doing too much. I can't really get very exercised in the way. I see a lot of people getting very exercised about, here we have a politician who's not honest. But then, nor do I think was Blair honest over Iraq. And is that more or less important than Johnson's dishonesty? Nor was Cameron honest over Libya, one of the greatest catastrophes of foreign policy of modern times. And he gets a free pass. It wouldn't be my angle of attack. I nearly was Boris Johnson?
Explain.
Well, there was a period in the 1990s when Have I Got News For You was quite rightly getting a lot of stick for being too left-wing. And so they were seeking a right-wing panellist. And I got a tryout, and he got a tryout. And the night I did it, the programme was more or less eaten by Clarissa Dixon Wright. You remember the two fat ladies?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, well, I won't go into it, but I made some perfectly serviceable jokes, one of which was stolen by one Anthony Wedgwood-Benn.
Outrageous behaviour.
And one of which wasn't stolen, and one of which was cut out by the makers of the programme. But I thought I did reasonably well, and it's a fantastic thing which happened in the weeks after I was on Have I Got News For You, was that I, for a very short period, became a real minor celebrity. That is to say, people would stop me in the street all the time and say, it was astonishing. I'd never experienced anything remotely like it. And that was just from one appearance. Now imagine if they'd selected me instead of him, and I'd been on Have I Got News For You as many times as he had, the celebrity power it would have given me.
So, Peter,
you could now be asking Boris Johnson what he thought of my morals.
I have to say, I am now flitting between amusement, I have to say I'm amused, and mild rage, because obviously I don't subscribe to the great man view of history. I think grand social forces played a major role in determining how things happen. But if they had gone for you over Boris Johnson,
imagine,
he may never have become...
All these things would not have happened because, in my view, everything that happened to him.
So basically,
Have I Got News For You created Boris Johnson as a national figure.
If you told maybe just two more great jokes, that
my
the political consequences.
My jokes were fine. There was nothing wrong with my jokes. You can look at it, you can watch the programme, and you can see what happened.
You should have ruffled your hair first.
It was just that Clarissa Dixon Wright was.
So
she was determined to dominate the programme at all costs, and that's what happened.
One of the two fat ladies...
Most of it had to be thrown away because, I think she's no longer with us now. But anyway, it was that close, is all I'm saying. It was like one of those John O'Hara novels in which somebody nearly becomes President of the United States. It could have been me. I am so lucky.
Well, all I'm saying is you can't libel the dead, so I'm going to say she played a very significant role in the destruction
of the history of the country. Yes, she did. People don't realise. You could write a novel about it. One of those moments, the sliding doors moments, in which the whole history of everything and everybody involved has changed.
Based on
it was one fat lady.
An overly boisterous performance by one fat lady.
Yep.
So, I very much take your point, by the way, in terms of often, you know, how politics is so trivialised. I get very angry when I bring up the war in Iraq, when some people roll their eyes and go, oh, it's so far, long away. And in 20 years' time, would people say if Putin, you know, the Ukraine war was 20 years ago, why are you still going on about it? Because it makes it sound like Arab lives don't matter, but...
I still go on about the Franco-Prussian war, for goodness sake, and I wasn't even around.
I mean, what they did to the Paris Commune...
It seems closer and closer as I get older. No.
But the point, what depressed me about what you just said, is how we shrug our shoulders and normalise dishonesty, because it's so corrosive to democracy. Because if people don't trust their politicians...
I'm not normalising dishonesty. I'm against it. But there are orders of magnitude. And the other thing in this whole business of the Cakegate is that, for me, the offence was not in having a piece of cake or drinking some foul wine in Downing Street. The offence was in formulating regulations which prevented other people from doing so. That was the wicked action. The thing which infuriated me was government taking powers they should never have taken, for reasons which didn't justify them. And the rest of it is trivial to me. And getting angry about the fact that he didn't keep regulations he had himself made is a waste of time. The question is, were the regulations justified in the first place? In my view, absolutely not. The whole thing was a terrible, disastrous mistake, like burning down your house to get rid of a wasp nest. And that's what he should be being excoriated for.
But we disagree, obviously, on the approach to the pandemic. But that notwithstanding, surely you understand the rage of people who couldn't hold the hands of their dying relatives, watch their relatives buried on Zoom.
Of course I understand.
And the guy in charge of communicating the rules didn't abide by it.
It's misdirected. They shouldn't be angry about him for having the cake. They should be angry about him for making making the regulations.
Do you think if we hadn't had the regulations, the death toll stands at about 170,000? Do you think it would have been any lower?
I think the evidence from Sweden suggests it would have been much the same.
Why was it much higher in Sweden than its neighbouring countries?
The interesting question, and I couldn't tell you. Sweden is perhaps more urbanised than the others. I don't know, but Sweden.
So the death toll is way more than all of them combined.
Yeah, but why would you make that comparison and no other? If you compare Sweden with other advanced European countries instead of just with its Scandinavian neighbours, it more or less comes out roughly the same, if not slightly better. The main problem that Sweden had was one which we had, is they completely messed up their care homes.
Of course.
Mess up.
That happened in Scotland as well.
Swedish care homes are bigger than British ones, and so the death toll from it was bigger. That has something to do with it, but the narrowing it down to Scandinavian comparison obscures the most fundamental fact that a country which didn't do what we did didn't suffer consequences any worse than either we had or than most other comparable European countries do.
We'll talk about COVID in a bit. Let's talk about Boris Johnson still. What about his political character? What is the political worldview / philosophy of Boris Johnson?
I don't think he has any politics. I simply don't think he has any political objectives. It's impossible to divine what they are. What does he believe in? I think he's one of these people who embraces policies in order to pursue office, rather than pursuing office in order to implement policies. Is there any evidence of a consistent belief system in anything he's ever said or done that you can see? Because I can't see any.
It strikes me, though, with the Tory kind of trauma or tumult going on, that when David Cameron and George Osborne were dominant, they had an economically pro-austerity, what I call an, you know, kind of authentic neoliberal roll-back-the-state approach. But they were seen as being socially liberal. I would question that given their policies in rhetoric and immigration, but that was how they were seen. Whilst the objection now for many on the right is you have a government which is far more socially conservative, but on the economy is more interventionist. And actually the objection lots of Tory MPs have at the moment is increasing corporation taxes.
What way is it more socially conservative?
Well, deporting migrants to Rwanda?
Well, I have to point out they haven't actually, as we sit here, deported anybody.
No, they want to.
Well, they want people to think they're going to deport people to Rwanda.
What do you think about deporting migrants to Rwanda?
I think it's probably impracticable. And it may not be the ideal destination. I don't think the idea of finding some way of deterring people from entering the country illegally is in itself wrong.
Why didn't it work in Israel when they did the same thing?
Why did it? Or didn't
it? It didn't work.
I have no idea. I've never looked into it. I mean, the only country...
Because I think it's immoral, but it's also
country,
unworkable.
Yeah, sure, but it's different. But the only country which I think has made anything of this kind work at all, and even there I think it's been called into question, is Australia. But they have much, much wider seas between them and the people who want to come to the country illegally.
I mean, Prince Charles, I don't actually...
But I don't. I mean, I think the purpose of it is not to send people to Rwanda. The purpose of it is to get people to stop coming across the channel.
Well, isn't...
If they could do that without sending anyone to Rwanda, they'd be perfectly happy.
I don't agree. I don't think that is the purpose.
But that's assuming that they believe they can do it.
No, but
you talked about David Cameron being conservative on immigration. He talked perpetually about bringing immigration down.
I know he did.
But he never actually did so.
He said to tens of thousands.
This is what conservatives do. They talk about bringing immigration down, but they don't actually do it.
Isn't the point of the Rwanda scheme to basically cause outrage from people like myself and to get it blocked? It didn't get blocked by obviously the recent judgment, unfortunately. But isn't the point actually... It's simply to appeal to a particular base who have very reactionary view on migrants and create political tension over the issue.
Leaving aside whether their view is very reactionary, certainly I think it has a political purpose. And I'm reminded of remember Theresa May's vans going around North London with their posters saying everybody would be deported, which of course they weren't going to be.
Go home.
That was aimed at the conservative voter base rather than at anybody who was actually illegally in the country. You probably couldn't have understood what was written on the vans anyway. So yes, I mean you're perfectly entitled to take a sceptical view of whether there's any real intent here. And you wouldn't necessarily find me disagreeing. I'm not a supporter of this government. I'm not a member of the Conservative Party. I don't have any reason to help it.
The reason I'm surprised, you know, for me, in my lifetime, I've never had a government which in any way aligns my political views. And I kind of resent you a bit because I think to myself, come on, Peter, you've got something so close, surely, to your own worldview, and you're still grumpy about it.
Nothing that this government does or says or has resemblance to anything that I desire.
What's your first big objection to this government? What is it about, as someone like yourself, I'd say, you know, a social conservative, small C, who hates the Conservative Party, but why? What about this government do you fundamentally object to?
All governments, particularly since 1997, have accepted as a fait accompli the social and cultural revolution.
In what way is this government accepting that revolution?
Well, it implements particularly the keystone piece of legislation, which is the Equality Act of 2010.
What's your objection to that?
Well, I don't actually accepts its categories as being the correct categories, nor do I believe that equality and diversity should be the governing principle of the country.
Do you think this government talks about diversity a lot?
In what it does, it does. If an actually conservative government, in the technical sense rather than in the title sense, came into being, it would have so many tasks. The most fundamental thing that has happened in this country really since the 1950s has been, first of all, the withdrawal of support by the state for the married family, and secondly, the acceptance by the state of the idea that there is no ultimate moral right and wrong, and that you therefore can no longer deter or punish wrongdoing. Those two things together have transformed the country completely. And they were achieved over a period of 20, 25 years by Labour and Conservative governments.
In what sense?
Well, first of all, the key piece of legislation on the family has to be the Harold Wilson Divorce Law Reform Act of 1968-69. The penal and criminal justice reforms of Roy Jenkins, similarly, removed the principle of punishment from the criminal justice system and also dismantled the police as a preventive organisation designed to prevent crime. So those are two key moments.
But we have far more people in prison now than we did in the 90s.
Yes, we do, and it's fascinating. And that's just a demonstration of how practically ineffective the policy is that they're adopted. We now use prisons as a final resort when we've... Most people who go to prison, unless they're homicides, will probably have committed something like 30 crimes before they ever get there. Many of those crimes not even noticed or prosecuted by the authorities. Then subject to cautions, to fines which went unpaid, to suspended sentences, to community service orders. And only by the time people have actually become habitual criminals, they actually get sent to prison. Read reports from magistrates' courts and see what the magistrates and the district judges are saying to the people they're sending to prison, or more often not sending to prison. The pressure on the judiciary not to send people to prison is huge. But what we have is an irreducible minimum of incompetent criminals who get caught and who have such long records that they have to send them to prison. That's what the prisons do now. Whereas, if prison was the experience as it used to be before this, of that came to you on a second offence, which used to be the first offence, people would, unless it was very serious, the courts would usually be lenient. But if you came on a second offence, and usually it would be prison, it acted as a deterrent. And if you look at prison population, not just in raw numbers, but per capita during the post-war period, it's the time after the criminal justice system goes soft and begins making excuses for criminals that the numbers of people in prison go up. So that is a paradox, which, like all paradoxes, is easily explained if you look, but most people don't look.
Well, just two things.
I mean, you asked me, so I'm telling you. I wrote a whole book about this years ago.
I mean,
so long ago that I'm now beginning to forget bits of it, but that bit I cannot forget.
I mean, the statistics show that people in prison are disproportionately people with some form of mental illness. They have most male prisoners one or two personality disorders. They're people often from deprived backgrounds who've been abused, gone through various trauma.
Quite so.
So is it not the case that our justice system is essentially locking up mentally ill poor people who've been failed?
There are a lot of mentally ill people in prison who ought to be in mental hospitals and would be if we still had the mental hospitals that Enoch Powell very stupidly closed down. It's amazing how Enoch Powell is rightly loathed for his Rivers of Blood speech, but his, in many ways, much worse action of closing down residential mental health provision in this country is forgotten. And an awful lot of people end up, the police are heavily burdened with dealing with them, the prisons contain them. If you visit a prison, which I expect you have done, the probably the most tragic part of the prison you'll see is the bit where the mentally ill people are. It's totally the wrong place for them. But in the end, the state has nowhere else to put them because it's dismantled the other provision it ought to have. That is true. Deprivation takes more than one form. Of course, it's true that that people who are who come from the more deprived part of society disproportionately end up in prison. But that isn't necessarily because of material poverty. It's because of the dismantling of authority, both in the home, increasingly in the schools, and also on the streets, which allows people who go wrong to go wronger and wronger and wronger. And if the middle class family breaks down, then generally, you know, there are two comfortable homes, there are seriously organized arrangements for the children to be looked after. If a poor family breaks down, there are serial boyfriends in the house, many of whom don't like the existing children. There is chaos. There is an almost total absence of responsible examples or authority figures.
Before I ask you about the family.
So you would get that. So it's not surprising that you would find most crime among the deprived. It's perfectly possible to be poor and to be well behaved. And many, many millions of people throughout history. You look at this country during the 20s and 30s, the poor people of this country living in circumstances of deprivation we would find unimaginable, almost totally free of crime.
Before I ask you about the family and marriage again, because I am interested in that, why do you think in Norway, who has a justice system based, which has a justice system very much based on rehabilitation, where sentences are shorter, and where prisons, I'll be honest with you, are kind of, as far as the Mail or the Daily, the Mail on Sunday would be concerned, would be this, you know, outrageous, idyllic settings and surroundings. Why is their reoffending rate so much lower than that of Britain?
I've never looked into it. I mean, it may
but
be
do you not think that would be an interesting point for you to consider, given...
It may be that it's quite difficult to find out a lot of this stuff, and I haven't had the time to do it. It may be that in Norway, being a much smaller society, in which I would imagine it's much harder to get away with crime without people knowing, that they get them earlier on. I don't know.
But it's just because
I can't talk about it because I don't know.
Which is, the US has a high reoffending rate and a high crime rate, but a very punitive justice system. Norway, the opposite form of justice system and a low reoffending rate.
I don't compare this country with other countries with totally different social structures. In the United States, I think we have to accept it's a very different country from this country. And indeed, the South of the USA is a very different country from the North.
It is.
And
west from east.
Are very different. No, the north and the south is the biggest difference. But I compare this country now with this country as it was. I think that demonstrable changes took place, which followed legislative and cultural change.
You wrote about marriage. By killing lifelong marriage, we are killing children. Liberal Britain cannot see this, but until somebody does, the tragedies will continue. Now, I understand very much your critique of the collapse of what's sometimes described as the traditional family, of marriage as a central institution, pillar of society. But, I mean, isn't it just the case that what we know as marriage, the institution of marriage, all the forms that relationships take, has drastically changed throughout the ages? We didn't used to have romantic love. People would be partnered up. Not on the basis of falling in love with each other. It would be based on other things. Women in the institution of marriage traditionally were enslaved. They were in prisons. They were the chattel of their husband. So, you know, the institution of marriage in the 14th century or the 18th century are very different from the 20th century. It's just the case, isn't it, that throughout the ages, the forms that relationships take just drastically change. It's barking at thunder to try and suggest you can sort of force people back into an institution that evolves so drastically all the time.
Some changes happen as a result of things which can't be controlled or altered. Some things happen, you know, the whole nature of society alters from a rural peasant society to an industrial, you know, urban society, to all kinds of things, which all kinds of things change. Other things change as a result of legislative decision. It may be that I'm not a propagandist for the past. I don't say that everything that happened in the past is better than what happened in the present. I say that the principal activity of anybody with any influence over events is choosing the future. And I'm saying that in the period when we undermined marriage, particularly in the 1960s, we chose the wrong future, and we pay for it all the time. The society which existed before the 1968 Act was not all that different from the society we have now. But the principal difference between the two, one of the principal differences between the two, is the fact that marriage is now so easily dissoluble.
Isn't that simple? I mean, if two people...
It didn't have to happen.
But if two people no longer love each other, they need to... I mean, look, the Children's Society did a study which suggested
divorce isn't permission to separate. Divorce is permission to remarry.
Right.
Two completely different things. If people don't wish to stay together, then no law is ever going to force them to stay together. But if you make marriage a state of life with considerable privileges and responsibilities, something which you can do serially and which you... The principal promise which the contracting parties make is broken, then you change the nature of the society in which it exists. And there's no other area of law in which this is the case. If you don't pay for some... If you buy a new computer and you don't pay for it, The person who sold it to you will come after you, and eventually, if you won't pay, in the county court. And because you have broken your side of the contract to pay the bill, the court will side with the guy who sold you the computer and make you pay.
But isn't that different?
If you break a marriage, then the court will side with the person who breaks the contract.
Yeah, but the difference between if you buy a computer and you don't pay for it is you're imposing a financial penalty for which someone else suffers because they have burdened the cost.
No, I'm just talking about the enforcement of promise.
No, I know, of course, but it's different, though, isn't it? Because what harm has done to...
One of the purposes of law is to enforce promise.
Sure.
People should be able to keep promises, but sometimes they don't, and if they don't, the law is there to reinforce the promise.
But I mean,
it's a unique feature of law that the promise of marriage is one which the courts will not back. They will actively side with the promise breaker against the promise keeper.
But it's an unrealistic absurdity, surely, to presume that you could ever treat whatever the marriage vow says. I understand. I've been to many weddings. I know how the vows go. It's a ludicrous fantasy to think that anybody could really promise, regardless of circumstances, that they will never part from the person that they have pledged to marry in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 years. That's just an absurdity.
I can only reply, that is your opinion. And this is not mine.
I want to talk about Keir Starmer. Now, you said he belonged to a Marxist faction. It's true. He was part of a left-wing collective. But so were you. You've changed. Obsessed with green politics and sexual revolution, well into his adulthood, and has never said he was wrong. And he will now be surprised. And you talked about there'll be this potential for permanent revolution, majority for the hard left. Now, let me just put this, make this very clear. Someone who's on the radical left. Keir Starmer stood for the Labour leadership. You talked about deceit, we talked about dishonesty. He stood on a platform, essentially of Corbynism without Corbyn, of radical domestic policies, of party unity, and he completely reversed all of those things. So your nightmare, which you've painted, of Keir Starmer leading some left-wing radical government, I would just very politely put to you, is not going to happen.
Well, that depends on what you think a radical left-wing government looks like. I think the Blair government was a radical left-wing government. I think the Blair government was the most radical government this country's had since Oliver Cromwell. And you don't.
Well, no, I mean... Well,
you don't, because in my you're unobservant and untutored in the ways of revolution. And I am observant and I am tutored in the ways of revolution. I know how it's done.
I just think you would have noticed the revolution in Cromwell's time and people didn't.
The whole point about modern revolution is that half of its point is that it's not noticeable.
Right.
It's the Kierkegaardian revolution where all the buildings remain standing but all the ideas change.
Can it truly be a revolution if people don't really notice it?
Yes.
I just think under Cromwell people really did notice it.
Most effective revolutions. Well, yes, but Cromwell had a very large army to make sure that people didn't.
That's what I mean.
People don't want to do this anymore. Wait, this is all... It's again, you're so young.
I'm not, though, unfortunately.
Well, you weren't alive in 1968.
I wasn't, mate. That's true.
What idealistic revolutionaries saw in 1968 was tanks. They saw what they had increasingly reluctantly viewed as their side, enforcing its will with tanks on the people of Czechoslovakia. And they were horrified.
My dad was in Czechoslovakia when that happened.
Well, there you are then.
And he was in Bratislava.
I bet he was horrified.
He was horrified. He was a Trotskyist.
And what the intelligent left began at that point to do was to rethink on a grand scale. I mean, there'd already been Trotskyists. I mean, I was a Trotskyist in 1968. But what happened was that to the mainstream communists, the European Social Democrats and the European communists, particularly the Italians, we can't carry on like this. This is not a... No one will ever support a movement which imposes its will by force with tanks. The Soviet experiment has been a disastrous failure, and yet we still wish to transform society. How do we do it? That's why when they began in large numbers to turn to Antonio Gramsci and his completely different theory of how you revolutionize.
Michael Gove quotes him quite a lot.
Of course he does, yes.
But on that, look, listen. New Labour.
Well, except, the interesting thing about Michael Gove is which side is he on in this revolution?
Well, that is an interesting, very interesting question. What New Labour did is accept the fundamental underpinnings of Thatcherism. The privatised utilities remained privatised. The anti-trade union laws largely remained in place. The top tax rate stayed the same. They cut corporation tax time and time again. Fundamentally, they accepted the free market capitalist settlement, but merely tried to humanise it. That's not a revolution.
So did Deng Xiaoping, roughly the same time, to get rich is glorious.
Yeah, but
they weren't bothered. The realisation among intelligent Marxists that attacking people for having money it was a futile waste of time.
But that's kind of
it's not. It's all part of the revision. Which took place after 68.
It's not Marxism anymore. If you accept a large capitalist class and even encourage them, how is it Marxism?
When did you last read the Communist Manifesto of 1848?
I've read it several times. It lauds capitalism originally.
What it is, it's fundamentally, as was the Paris Commune, which also got Marx into ecstasies, it's fundamentally a rerun of the 1789-93 French Revolution. It's a Jacobin document. It's much more about the reordering of human existence than it is about economic seizure of power.
But the whole point
this is the revolutionary roots of all left wing movements are 18th century France, not 20th century Russia, and it's and the 1968 took revolutionaries, intelligent revolutionaries, back to 18th century France.
Yeah, but the point about what Marx is...
Notice, I mean, for instance, the very vigorous attack on Christianity, which the left has been making in recent years. It comes from the same thing.
He was a devout Christian.
Well...
But just on that, look, I mean, what Marxism argued was, capitalism, you know this, he used to be a Trotskyist, created a proletariat which would become the gravedigger of capitalism, and by overthrowing the bourgeoisie... What the proletariat would do is eliminate all class distinctions.
Also, by the 1960s, everybody else...
But that's not what Blairism did.
Everybody knew that was wrong, too. The attempts to find a substitute for the proletariat, for instance, in the Third World, the Frantz Fanon view, all that, all that was also going on because the proletariat had stopped being a proletariat. The proletariat let down the vanguard party, and they needed to replace it with something else. That wasn't going to happen. Proletarian revolution was an Edwardian diversion.
What genuine threat? Because you said you don't like Johnson. In fact, you think he's terrible. But you were reluctant to join an attack upon him because you think things could get significantly worse.
No, I didn't say that.
You said because things could be a lot worse. I'm reading your own writing here, by the way. I'm just reading about your column. You're arguing that Keir Starmer's government will essentially be this hard left revolutionary government. And I suppose my question is...
We already have a hard left revolutionary government.
Do we now?
Yes.
Do we?
In my view, yes.
How? Why is it hard left?
Well, look around. Obviously, the continued destruction of the married family.
How are they destroying the marriage family? Boris Johnson's destroyed the marriage family personally.
Egalitarian comprehensive education.
They want to reopen grammars. Well, they're throwing that as red meat.
No, I'm telling you what it looks like to me. A foreign policy of liberal interventionism rather than national defence. A rapidly accelerating dismantling of the country itself. The acceptance of constitutional reforms, which are fundamentally of the...
What constitutional reforms?
Well, the main constitutional reforms of recent years were those, again, during the Blair Revolution, of the breakup of the country.
You want the breakup of the country. You want English independence.
Now I do, because I recognise the country has broken up.
But it hasn't broken up.
Well,
it's still intact.
There's still a few bits of news. It's held together with Post-it notes. There's nothing. The thing has no real continuity.
Do you think Wales will go.
I find this interesting because one thing at a time. I mean, I'm trying to explain to you how it is that I see this. Some of the highest levels of taxation ever seen in this country now exist as well. The interference in people's private life at an unprecedented level. I don't think that this is it would be wrong to call this a country run by what I would regard as far left.
Interference in private life. I mean, given your views on marriage, I'm surprised at that because you do want interference in people's private lives, surely.
No, I want people to be allowed to. What the government has done is actively weakened the institution of marriage. It's actively weakened parental authority. It's actively weakened at the same time, say, the authority of teachers over pupils, as they're no longer called. It's done all kinds of things of that kind, which have actually had the paradoxical effect of strengthening the power of the state.
The family being
the principal rival of the state in terms of power and influence over people.
That was my fault. I did a segue back to marriage. I mean, you're not proposing that the government would just overturn devolution.
I'm not proposing anything. I have no program. I keep trying to explain this to people. I just sit and laugh. I have no...
You become a nihilist?
No, I just know that I have no chance of influencing political development.
Why do you want English independence? Why not? Because it's just the left is often accused of wanting to destroy the country.
Why sit around waiting? Why sit around waiting so all the other parts of the United Kingdom are sliced off? Why sit around? It's okay, right. If that's what you want. Have it.
But it's just I support you.
I don't believe in sitting around waiting to have chamber pots emptied over my head by other people. If they want us to go, then let us get up and go. Of our own free will. That's all. I don't see any reason to sit around waiting for the further humiliations to be heaped upon us by Nicola Sturgeon and whoever, and not to mention Sinn Féin.
Well, United Ireland is looking closer than ever. You're absolutely right. Let's talk about Ukraine. Now, I'm someone who would describe myself as being from the anti-war left. I regard the Iraq War as the greatest crime of our time. Hundreds of thousands of people slaughtered based on a pack of lies, including obviously several British service personnel, but hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians. Libya, another absolute catastrophe based on a lie, as you've just pointed out. My view on what's happened in Ukraine is a kleptocratic, Russian, revanchist, chauvinist government, which is not inspired by the Soviet Union, actually very much against, is essentially a kind of neo-czarist, greater Russian, blood and soil Russian nationalist project, has, without any provocation whatsoever, invaded an independent country which democratically elected its president and unleashed a barbaric war, including laying to waste entire cities and slaughtering innocent civilians. Surely that is how we should see the war. And therefore, as one from the anti-war left, I would support arming Ukraine in that war of national self-defense so that the inevitable peace settlement, which I support, is as much on the terms of Ukraine as possible.
This is one of those moments, very common in modern Britain, where knowing anything about the subject is a profound disadvantage.
In what sense?
Well, I mean, I knew where Ukraine was before 6 weeks ago. Been there, sure, for another thing. I know some history of it for another. And the key, how shall I put it, error in what you just said was the phrase without provocation. Now, even Robert Kagan, you know who Robert Kagan is?
Explain though for the viewers.
Well, he's the husband of Victoria Nuland, who is in charge of the United States Ukraine policy. He's a well-known neoconservative thinker. Wrote recently in Foreign Affairs magazine that of course there had been provocation in Russia. In this he joined all kinds of people, from Henry Kissinger to John Mearsheimer, to many, many others in diplomacy and politics over the past many years, who've said that the westward expansion of NATO was a grave mistake and would cause problems. Now, to say that something was provoked is not to say that something was either good or wise, but to pretend that it wasn't provoked is absurd. The other thing is, there's a great inquiry going on in Washington, D.C. at the moment about the events of January 2021, in which a bunch of violent oafs tried to seize the U.S. Capitol. And quite right, too, it's a disgraceful episode. It needs to be investigated and exposed. But it seems to me that an equal amount of scrutiny should be aimed at the violent mob putsch, which, unlike the January 2021 events, was successful in Kiev in February of 2014, when the legitimately elected president of Ukraine was overthrown by a violent mob with the backing of the United States.
Do you not think, following whatever we think about the so-called Maidan Revolution, there was a free and fair election after that, and there have been free and fair elections in Ukraine since?
Because
Zelensky won over 71%,
Zelensky is the second person to have been elected since that event. The first thing you remember was Petro Poroshenko.
And he was the less aggressive towards Russia.
But let's go back to, instead of changing the subject, let's go back to the initial point. First of all, there's no question, the newspaper with which you're principally associated, The Guardian, reported in 2010 that there was no question that Yanukovych had been fairly elected.
I don't dispute that.
Good, right.
So people know, he's more pro-Russian. That's just so everyone.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. Though I don't think you'd find the Russians would agree that the way he screwed them over Sevastopol and gas prices was particularly pro-Russian. It's a characterization made of him by outsiders who know little of Ukrainian politics.
Fair enough.
He was ultimately pro-Ukrainian, but his constituency tended to be among the Russian speakers of the East rather than the different part of Ukraine that lies to the West. Yeah. And his party tended to get his support from there. But that's another. So we have, first of all, settlements. He was legitimately elected. Secondly, we have to accept that he was not lawfully removed from office.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Do you know what happened? I mean, do you know the visit by the foreign ministers of Poland, France and Germany to attempt to get the Ukrainian opposition to achieve a compromise on February 21st and 22nd of 2014? And the deal which they came up with, in which Yanukovych offered and agreed to early elections, constitutional change. Do you know about this document?
Yeah, tell me more.
Well, I haven't got it with me, but it's if you want the complete story, Richard Sackler's excellent book, Frontline Ukraine, gives the whole story and indeed the details of the document. Among those who present was for instance, Radek Sikorski. But it was a very heavyweight delegation of very senior European political and diplomatic figures, and they came up with this. And the supposed moderates among the Ukrainian opposition speaking for the Maidan, who were supposed to sell this deal, took it to the Maidan and were told by the mob leaders that they were not accepting it, that Yanukovych must go, and that if he did not go, they would take arms and march on his house. Shortly after that, as Sakwa describes it, what remained of the security forces in central Kiev disappeared. And Yanukovych, having a pretty good idea of what might happen to him if he stuck around, left. There was then a supposed impeachment procedure in Kiev in the days afterwards, in which they couldn't actually raise enough votes to fulfill the conditions of the impeachment law. And during which, this is another crucial fact, there were armed men in the debating chamber of the Ukrainian Rady, the Ukrainian Parliament. This was a putsch. And one of the people who says so is Jack Matlock, who was Ronald Reagan's ambassador to Moscow, a very senior American diplomat. He says it was a putsch. I very much agree with him. I think that it has all the characteristics of a putsch: violence, the overthrow of a legitimate government, and its replacement by an illegitimate government without lawful or constitutional procedure. That's a putsch. And it was also backed, as we know, for you know about the bleep the EU tape.
The what was the last one?
Bleep the EU.
Bleep.
Well, I'm being polite.
Oh, sorry. Bleep, as in F-U-C-K-E-U.
Yes, as in Victoria Nuland's conversation with the American ambassador to Ukraine, which she was discussing in great detail the kind of government which the United States wanted in Kiev, which was different from the one which it had. There's no question there was American involvement in this. And so this was it involved considerable violence. There's a great dispute, and this is not idle. Serious academics have not been able to come up with a clear idea of who is responsible. Beyond doubt, significant numbers of police officers defending the government were shot dead during this. the opening shots in the Ukrainian war were not fired when the Russians mounted their barbaric and stupid invasion. They were fired during the putsch in February 2014, and immediately war began. A very serious war in which, I have to say, Ukrainians behaved very badly towards Russian-speaking civilians.
I wrote about how human rights watch, and I'm seeing some actual actually detail about
this war.
This
war is 8 years old. It's not new.
You cited Henry.
So provocation. There is provocation.
Henry Kissinger, you cited, for example, and the reason you cited him because he's associated often with the hawkish foreign policy. But Henry Kissinger is a war criminal. Is you know, he's the exemplar of realpolitik, and his objection is, his fear is, the main rival to US power is China, and he's fearful of Russia and China welding together the block. The point I'd make to you, this whole point about provocation, this, you know, Meerschaum. Now, the argument is the same, which is basically to Latin America.
You say he's a war criminal?
No, I'm not saying he's definitely not a war criminal, just to avoid being sued by Meerschaum for no reason. No, he's not. No, Henry Kissinger is a war criminal. The argument there basically is this. If you have the bad luck...
Is Noam Chomsky a war criminal?
No.
Because it's the one thing.
I don't think...
It's the one thing about... It's the one thing on the planet...
I've interviewed Noam Chomsky about this.
Noam Chomsky and Henry Kissinger agree. No. They both agree.
I'm saying Henry Kissinger is a war...
NATO was a provocation.
Yeah, sorry, Peter. I'm saying Henry Kissinger is a war criminal because he carpet bombed Southeast Asia. That's why I'm calling him a war criminal.
Yeah, okay. But
just to be absolutely clear,
it's not really relevant to the point.
Just to be very clear. The argument, the realist kind of perspective here, is if you have the if you've got the misfortune to live next to a great power, bad luck, mate, but you're going to have to play a smart game or you're going to get provoked by them. So an example of that would be this. Chile, 1973, they had a left-wing president, Salvador Allende. Henry Kissinger himself said, I do not see why we have to let a country go communist because of the irresponsibility of their own people. My parents took in Chilean refugees who fled Pinochet's regime. Now, Chile had the right to determine its own future. Just because it happens to be near a great power it didn't like in their backyard.
No, the point I'm making is the same thing.
Ukraine,
it's not the same
but
thing.
But Ukraine has elected freely and fairly.
I'm arguing very narrowly.
Right.
That you said that it was without provocation.
But do you think electing Allende was a provocation to the United States?
Hang on a minute. You said I'm sticking to one subject.
Generally,
people who are losing the argument change the subject.
I'm not changing the subject.
Well, then don't change the subject.
I'm extending your logic.
Here is my simple point.
In which I
have challenged your initial presentation that you said it was without provocation. And I say it was not without provocation.
I don't think that
absolutely.
There wasn't an attack. There was no attack on Russia. Russia was not attacked by anyone in Ukraine. There was no attack on Russian soil.
Wait a minute. Provocation, and again, you need to read Robert Kagan on this, doesn't necessitate an attack. Kagan also listed, which I wouldn't have had the nerve to do because I'm not an American, he listed Roosevelt's maneuvering of Japan into attacking the United States in 1941 as a provocation. Of course, he also listed, as I think anybody who knows any history does, Bismarck's maneuvering of Napoleon III into war in 1870 with the Ems Telegraph. And it is not unknown for countries to maneuver other countries into being the aggressor.
No, but the point I'm making
by
is
provocation.
There is no need grounds of self-defense for Russia to invade Ukraine.
Kagan is absolutely not on my side in this matter, but he is, on the other hand, an informed and intelligent person with, as we know, extremely high contacts in the United States government. And he says that Russia was provoked. It's absurd to say it wasn't provoked.
He's entitled to his opinion.
Thank you. I'm sure he's glad you think so.
It just seems like an appeal to authority. That's the point, and that's a logical fallacy, Peter.
There's a serious argument among people who hate Russia.
Sure.
There's a serious argument that there was provocation in this. Then I think you have to accept it's quite likely that there was.
I think that's an appeal to authority, which is a logical fallacy.
Not axiomatically.
The point I'm just being, just to be very clear, I don't see how it can be deemed to be a provocation, which obviously leads to a war. You oppose, by the way, it's very, very important to make that clear. But unless a country is attacked by another country, unless its citizens are attacked, its military personnel, its soil, it cannot justly claim to have been legitimately provoked into any form of armed action, and therefore no legitimate provocation took place, which justifies a war which has killed tens of thousands of people already, including working class Russians who've been lobbed into this horrendous war and ripped from their families at the age of 19.
I don't agree. I mean, it's a very interesting doctrine, but I don't agree. And I think that you can, it's perfectly possible to provoke countries without without actually attacking them. And indeed, it's it can be a very useful tactic in war, as Kagan pointed out. And the provocation has been a very long one. The other person who I've waited till this point to mention here is George Kennan, the inventor of the whole diplomatic strategy of containment of the Soviet Union, who came out of retirement to warn against NATO expansion on exactly these grounds. There's no shortage of people. Putin himself, in his speech at the Munich Security Conference, said, what is all this for? And the response the year afterwards, at the NATO Bucharest Conference, to Putin saying, why are you doing this? Was not, oh, well, let's consider this, but an offer heavily sponsored by that genius of military and diplomatic strategy, George W. Bush, an offer to Ukraine and Georgia that they should become members of NATO. Very strongly, I have to say, against the advice of many European Union leaders who thought this was an act of folly and indeed provocation. And so it turned out this was not an unpredictable crisis. This is a crisis that's been predicted since, say, George Kennan began to warn against it back in 1998.
I don't support NATO. If there was a referendum in this country, I'd vote to leave NATO. So just to be absolutely clear about my own position and credentials on that issue, the point I would put to you is this.
There isn't going to be one.
No. I think this is. I want you to engage with this point because I think it's an important point.
No.
Well, let me just put it to you and then you can decide whether to engage with it. From my perspective, Western power, Western imperialism, is responsible for the greatest global crimes. Iraq being most notable recently. I could go back to Vietnam, Henry Kissinger, we keep citing. Whether it be, obviously, you could cite Libya. You know, so many catastrophes which have decimated the
you
lives.
You mentioned Syria, I noticed.
Okay. We could talk also about Western involvement in Syria, but we're going to get distracted. So the point I'm making about Eastern Europe is their perspective is this. Look. They might say you're absolutely right about Iraq and elsewhere, but our history is one of Russian domination and fear of Russian power. And they would be able to cite, over many centuries, subjugation by Russia in various incarnations, and that's what they fear the most. And the reason they've been driven into the arms of NATO is a legitimate fear of Russian expansionism.
Before 1991, when was Ukraine an independent nation?
But you could say this about anything.
No, I'm asking a question. Before 1991, when was Ukraine an independent nation?
Well, briefly after the Brest-Litovsk.
No, it was just a German puppet.
It was 1918.
It was a German puppet in 1918.
Fine.
When was Ukraine last independent?
Well, Kurdistan's never been an independent country, but I see Kurdistan as a nation. Do you think Kurdistan's a nation?
But I haven't said it isn't a nation. I'm saying that Ukraine's independence in its current form dates from 1991.
Yeah.
How was it obtained?
Through a referendum.
Through a referendum.
In which overwhelmingly people voted for independence.
I know this. No, don't treat me as if I don't know. It was obtained through a referendum. Did Russia offer any resistance to the outcome of that referendum or prevent Ukraine prevent Ukraine from becoming independent or in any way hamper Ukraine's independence or do anything to get in the way of Ukraine's independence?
No,
for many, many years afterwards, there was no conflict between the two at all.
Do you think Putin, if he was in charge at the time, would have allowed that to happen? I don't think so.
He wouldn't have had any choice.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I don't like Yeltsin.
I'm not going to go into this theorizing about what Putin supposedly wanted to re-establish the Soviet Union. If you want to believe that, you can. I don't.
Okay. I think he wants the Russian Empire.
I don't think he wants the Russian Empire. It's not. Ukraine is an independent country. The country which began arming and equipping and giving military advice to Ukraine from 1991 was which country? I've told you the answer to this. When did American military aid to Ukraine begin? The moment it became independent.
Okay.
1991.
And a quid pro quo was nuclear disarmament in 1994.
No, Ukraine never had any nuclear weapons.
It did.
No, Ukraine had on its territory nuclear weapons belonging to the Soviet Union. It had nuclear weapons in the sense that Britain had the American the American missiles stationed in Holy Loch. There were no, the Ukraine never had control over over Soviet nuclear weapons. It never had the launch codes, and it wasn't able to secure them. It's a fantasy. Kazakhstan makes the same fatuous argument. Ukraine was never a nuclear power and didn't give up being a nuclear power.
The reason, just
quite. To the extent that it's at all relevant to the point, but I have to correct this factually. Within months of Ukraine becoming independent, it began to receive American advice and aid.
Okay.
For why?
Well, I mean, look, I'm not an apologist for US foreign policy, so I'm probably the wrong person to interrogate on that basis.
You're the person who says there's been no provocation.
No.
If Scotland successfully achieved independence, say, in September this year, if they managed to hold the second referendum and the independent side won it, and immediate Chinese military advisors arrived in Glasgow, what do you think the response would be in London?
I mean,
what do you think we'd say? But, what do you think we'd do?
But I think the reason...
I mean, even absolutely no doubt...
The reason a government
in London, if Scotland declared independence, would say, OK, this is your wish. I hope they'd be as nice about it as possible. They certainly wouldn't say, right, we're coming for you. Nor would there be any hostility. But if immediately...
Yeah, sure. But
after a peaceful departure,
right,
obtained by a referendum, a neighbouring country begins to accept military advice from a distant foreign power, it begins to start people wondering what's going on. Are you familiar with Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard? And his theory of the importance of Ukraine?
Yes, I know that I'm not...
You know how he views Ukraine as being strategically the most important.
Just on this, can I just respond? Sorry, you just made such a long point there in many different subpoints.
Okay.
Now,
you make some long points as well.
True. If there were Chinese military advisors, if Scotland, an independent Scotland, moved into the Chinese military orbit, there's no question that would receive a hostile reaction from the Westminster government. If the Westminster government then responded by invading Scotland and wiping out Aberdeen, there would be nothing more to say on that, other than that is a monstrous, unprovoked invasion.
Yes, but you see, I'm not arguing that, as you've rightly...
But I don't regard that as provocation.
As you've rightly pointed out, I'm not arguing that the Russian invasion was justified or right. No. I am saying it was provoked. And I'm saying it was provoked over a very long period of repeated, in my view, stupidity. If you ignore someone with the intelligence and experience of George Kennan, then you're stupid.
It's appeal to authority. That again, look, just
it's not an appeal to authority. It's an appeal to experience. Peter, it's an appeal to fact.
Make this point so you can engage with it.
I want to be clear what it is we're arguing about.
Yeah, of course. But if you listen to what Putin or Medvedev or all the other senior Russian officials around them are saying, they are making very, very clear that this is about greater Russian nationalism. They talked about deep...
Do you speak Russian?
No, but I've read the translations, which I presume are not being fabricated. De-Ukrainization. Putin's speech on the eve of the invasion of Ukraine, where he ranted about Vladimir Lenin for creating the entity of Ukraine and how it wasn't a legitimate entity. The whole basis, the rhetoric of the Russian regime, is that Ukraine is not a legitimate political entity.
Where does he say that?
That it doesn't have... That's what he said in his speech.
Where did he say it? What is the quotation?
Do you want me to bring up...
Yeah, I do, because people keep telling me this.
Okay.
Where did Putin say Ukraine is not a legitimate country?
He said, Putin's speech, eve of invasion. This is ludicrous. I'll start with the fact that modern Ukraine was entirely created by Russia, more precisely Bolshevik Communist Russia. This process began almost immediately after the revolution in 1917, and Lenin and his associates did it in a very rude way towards Russia itself, by separating, tearing away from it part of his own historical territories. Of course, no one asked about anything to the millions of people who lived here. Then on the eve and after the Great Patriotic War, Stalin already annexed the USSR and transferred to Ukraine some lands that previously belonged to Poland, Romania and Hungary. At the same time, as a kind of compensation, Stalin endowed Poland with part of the original German territories, and 1915 before Khrushchev, for some reason, took away Crimea from Russia and gave it also to Ukraine. Actually, this is how the territory of Soviet Ukraine was formed. As a result of the Bolshevik policy, Soviet Ukraine arose, which even today can with good name reason be called Ukraine, named after Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. He is its author and architect. This is fully confirmed by archival documents, including Lenin's harsh directive in the Donbass, which was literally squeezed into Ukraine. And now grateful descendants have demolished monuments to Lenin in Ukraine. The point he is making there is Ukraine is not illegitimate. It's not illegitimate.
He doesn't say that. You can't find the words there because he didn't say them.
Right.
There is a long and complicated argument about the nature of the of what was the Soviet Republic of Ukraine.
All countries are arbitrary. There is a
long and complicated argument about that because if you were trying to design a country to function independently as Ukraine, nobody would choose the borders which Ukraine has. But he's not at any point saying Ukraine is not a legitimate country. People constantly say this. The words are not there. Any more than Jim Callaghan said, crisis, what crisis? He didn't say that. But people are constantly telling me he said it. Argue about what he actually does say, which is a much more complicated.
What does Medvedev, the former prime minister and the stooge president of Putin, when he talks about de-Ukrainization, what do you think he's talking about?
I don't know.
Oh, come on.
I don't know.
Come on now. De-Ukrainization is just, look, is it most extreme? It's genocidal rhetoric. Let's just be brutally honest about it. If you say we're going to de-Britify Britain, what are we talking about?
What's the context? What's he saying?
I'll bring it up if you want. We can bring up these quotes. I think.
I'm not contesting it. I just don't know. I just don't know what it is you're referring to. I'm asking you what he actually said.
Okay.
If you tell me what he actually said, the word by itself doesn't tell me much.
Well. So he says, well, he talked as well. He said, deep Ukrainization is a fictional concept fueled by anti-Russian poison and an all-consuming lie about its identity is one big fake. This phenomenon has never happened in history and now it doesn't exist. Ukraine, he said, will suffer its own fate, having mentally transformed into the Third Reich. Having written down the names of Jews and Nazi henchmen into history books, there she is, dear, such Ukraine. Russia's most important goal is to change the bloody and full of false myths.
He seems there to be denouncing de-Ukrainization as something he doesn't accept.
No, he said deep Ukrainization. He's talking about how Ukrainianism.
Oh, I thought you
he talked about de-Ukrainization as well to reverse that process.
Okay, well, I don't know about that. I mean, it seems to me to be a diversion from the point.
Well, no, but I'm saying the rhetoric of the Russian regime is hostility to the very concept of Ukraine as a nation.
What are we arguing?
I'm arguing about
when did this war start?
But I'm saying Russia's war aims are driven by provocation.
When did this war start? What is it about?
Right.
And if you like, if you're interested in discussing whether this country should be involved in arming Ukraine, then what is our interest in doing so? That's what I'm arguing. I'm saying it was unquestionably provoked, and I think the admission of Robert Kagan of this is absolute. If someone on that side admits it, even if you don't accept George Kennan's protests, and if you don't accept Jack Matlock's description of the events of 2014 as a putsch, even if you don't accept that, and if you don't see any worrying nature in George W. Bush's behavior in Bucharest in 2008. If you don't, even then, you still have to accept that there is a serious argument that this action was.
I oppose NATO expansion.
Provoked. The point. Okay, well, like,
but the point I'm making is, I understand why Eastern Europeans have a different perspective to me, because an Eastern European will tell me, I've been told off by people in Eastern Europe for being tone deaf on this particular issue, is they will say to me, it's easy for you to make this argument, but you haven't lived under the shadow of Russia in various different incarnations, which sees Eastern and Central Europe as its favourite.
I'm not unfamiliar with Eastern Europe myself.
I know, I'm not trying to patronise you, I'm just trying to explain what Eastern Europeans have told
me. Well, I'm not unfamiliar, but the truth is that the first of the former Soviet controlled areas to become NATO members were Latvia, Estonia and Lithuania.
Yeah.
In what year did they do so?
What, 1990, wasn't it? When they became independent. I mean, they were annexed by Stalin, to be fair.
But that's not the point. The point is, I think there were 13 years between their declarations of independence and their, I have to check this, but certainly a very long period between their declarations of independence and their accession to NATO.
Yeah, it was a long period.
Well, during that time, were they threatened with Russian takeover?
Well, you've got senior, you've got certainly on Russian state television pundits talking about how they need to go into the Baltic states and even attack Poland.
Well, maybe you have, but I'm not asking you that. I'm asking you, was there any serious suggestion that that their sovereignty was under threat? The answer is no. Well,
Putin's, you could say he's invaded Georgia.
The answer is no. Georgia, as the Tagliavini report clearly shows, Georgia provoked that event by making the attack. It was Georgian shelling that began that attack. There isn't any question. This is a European Union Commission report. And it says so, and it was started by Georgia, and there are interesting arguments about why that should have been, but it was.
Just finally on Ukraine, how do you think the war? How do you see a last? Because at the end of the day, there has to be some sort of settlement. It's an inevitability of sort of that's how war.
We
has
haven't
to end.
Really got anywhere on whose fault it is. What the real reason is for it, or what Britain's interest is.
I think Russian war aims are driven by greater Russian chauvinism and nationalism. I think you
can think that as much as you like. You haven't produced any evidence for it.
I think that Putin speech, we have obviously a very different interpretation.
I've seen a lot of people telling me what the Putin speech meant. Putin is not some great intellectual historian,
no.
But he likes to talk about history. He does. He's a long disquisition. What he's basically doing is explaining that the current shape of Ukraine, the shape of Ukraine in which it became independent in 1991, was as far as I recall, he actually uses the phrase was the result of the actions of the Central Committee of the Soviet Communist Party, a body for which he and nobody else has any lingering respect. It was a very awkward shaped country in which to seek independence. And here is a thing which you won't like to know, but we've discussed how Ukraine left the power of Moscow through a referendum which was respected by Moscow in 1991. In 1992, the people of Crimea tried under the Ukrainian constitution lawfully to hold a referendum on the status of Crimea, in which it was certain they would have voted to leave Ukraine if they'd been given the chance, and they were forced to cancel it under threats of violence from Kiev. So it's okay. It's okay for Ukraine to leave Russia under a referendum, and for there to be, and for Russia to say, fine, you go. And Russia is still condemned as a dreaming imperial power. But if Crimea wishes to leave Ukraine, as Ukraine left the power of Russia, then Ukraine prevents Crimea from doing so. This is a historical fact.
But can I just, in 1991, in the referendum for Ukrainian independence, 55% of the people of Crimea voted for independence.
Well, there's a complicated thing. What they were actually voting, they voted for independence from the Soviet Union. And the issue of the referendum was partly to do with the Soviet Union. I don't think there's any doubt at all. Huge numbers of people signed a petition in early 92 asking for a very large.
Well, I'm surprised 45% of them opposed independence.
Sorry?
Well, 45%, fine. It's like Remainers. No, you could say Remainers petitioned against 48%.
Ukraine in 1992. Have you got that I'm referring to 1992?
Yes, I have, but that's not
that 30 years. 30 years ago.
Yeah, but it's not this that long after the referendum in 1991, in which they voted for independence.
But if Ukraine was so confident that the majority of the Crimean people were going to vote to stay in Ukraine, why did they prevent the referendum from taking place?
Well, you could say
which they did, not lawfully. But with threats of violence.
Why did Theresa May stop another referendum on Brexit, you had all these marches and petitions
by
Remainers?
It's a good question, but there it is. It's not the one I'm asking.
Well, no, I'm just saying, look, the losing side in a referendum referendum.
The point I'm making is that Ukraine, in the shape in which it became independent in 1991, was not ideally designed. It's not unreasonable to say so, particularly the Khrushchev transfer of Crimea to Ukraine in 1954.
If Ukraine isn't armed by Western powers, what would happen to Ukraine, do you think, in the current context?
Well, if Ukraine stayed out of Western alliances, nothing would have happened.
Do you think now if Ukraine say we won't join NATO ever again, the war would just end? We'll never join NATO.
NATO isn't necessarily the point. I mean, NATO membership doesn't prevent a NATO member from intervening in the war in Ukraine. Britain is not, by its adherence to NATO, prevented from sending troops to fight in Ukraine or declaring war on Russia, nor is the United States. It's a fantasy that NATO membership actually prevents us from doing these things. The reason why Britain and the United States and France and Germany and all the other NATO members are not doing this is not because Ukraine isn't in NATO, it's because they don't want to. If they wanted to, they have the sovereign power. In fact, the NATO treaty itself is so vague that it wouldn't compel them to if Ukraine were a NATO member.
Pete, just a straightforward question.
Article 5 is greatly overrated.
If military arms now were not given to Ukraine, what do you think would happen to Ukraine in that context? If all arms stopped, like now, this second, what would happen to Ukraine?
I don't know.
The Russians would just march all the way through, surely.
I'm not a military expert.
Well, they'd take Kyiv, wouldn't they?
I don't know. Do they want to take it?
Well, I think originally they wanted a lightning strike in Kyiv. That was they just went into Butcher, murdered huge numbers of innocent people, put them in mass graves, raped people.
So we know that. I mean, the war is horrible, and if you don't like atrocities, don't have them. But I'm not defending the war, nor am I defending the invasion.
But I'm saying they wanted to take Kyiv.
What I'm saying is, I don't know what the objectives.
Why did they have a convoy go to Kyiv?
I don't know.
Well, because they wanted to
They
wanted to take Kyiv.
I don't know.
You don't send a military convoy on the way to a capital unless you want to take the capital.
Are you? Have you done the Camberley staff course? Are you expert in land warfare? Because I'm not. I don't know why they did it.
You don't have to be an expert in military warfare to know that if you're sending a massive armed convoy on the way to a city, you probably plan to take the city. Otherwise, why would you waste all that resources?
There are arguments.
Just to go through the Ukrainian countryside.
The question then you have to ask is why they didn't do it, but it's not of any interest. What is the purpose of this invasion?
Well, they're going to annex large parts of Eastern Ukraine to Russia.
Well, they might.
Including Mariupol. They're going to do what they did in Grozny.
They might do that, yes. But do you actually think the intention was to seize Ukraine and invade it and sort of
impose a puppet regime?
Right, but I have no way of knowing that. I've never seen the objectives of the operation announced.
Just finally, again,
lots of people telling me what they were. I don't know what, but I don't know. I'm not. I make no claims to it. I've never even been in the combined cadet force. I have no knowledge of military tactics or strategy.
What do you think?
I couldn't even dismantle a rifle.
What do you think the likely outcome of this war would be? And do you think there could be a lasting settlement?
There was a lasting settlement available before it started in Minsk too. Which was, but the United States particularly wouldn't put any force behind it. So it never came to be. Either you could have a settlement tomorrow if there was a desire for a settlement. But I strongly suspect there are certainly elements in the United States who want a long war. And it may well be that the Russian response will be okay. If you want a long war, you can have one.
Do you think the likely outcome of this, in terms of the decline of Western power, the context of the decline of Western power, because the reason, as I mentioned Kissinger before, his concerns about the Ukraine conflict is, for people like Kissinger, the main strategic rival to the United States is China, and the lasting outcome...
There is something in what he says, isn't there?
Well, the lasting outcome is likely to be Russia ever more firmly as a junior partner in the bloc, because the whole point of Nixon going to China, of course, was to divide the Soviet Union and China.
In those days, the Soviet Union was a global military...
Mm-hmm. And Russia is an enfeebled
political
state.
Power. Russia is a... Is a rust heap with the gross domestic product size of Italy.
Yeah, with a much bigger population, so per capita much lower, yeah. So do you think that's the likely outcome of all of this actually for the West is bad news because, for Western strategic interests, because it will mean a power bloc led by China, maybe even India. I mean, India and China historically have had rivalries, but they've moved closer together.
See, I have no idea. But what I can say is I can see no sense in this. If the United States or Britain or Russia were trying to run intelligent, self-interested foreign policy, I can see no sense in anything that any of them have been doing for the past several months. It's all stupid. But the problem is, any reading of history, you will find that most people behave stupidly most of the time, so that's nothing new. But it's stupid. What is the point of it? What does the United States gain? What does Europe gain? What does Ukraine gain? What does Russia gain? What does Britain gain? Nothing. It's just piles of corpses.
Right now,
tens of thousands of corpses and millions of refugees who were formerly happy, contented human beings. What's the point of that?
Very strongly agree with that.
It was provoked, and it was, and I'm afraid that the people who provoked it, whether it doesn't matter whether you what you think about the rightness or wrongness of the Russian action. I think, to me, it was one of the worst pieces of news I've ever heard in my life. It's so wrong and stupid was it, but there it was. Whatever you think of it, nonetheless, those who provoked it have to take some responsibility for it.
Finally, we've covered lots of ground, so let's try and wrap up. I would say try and do an optimistic note, but I've rarely heard you say anything optimistic on your own terms. You're not.
You really say?
I was going to try and end on an optimistic note, but I have to say you're not one of life's natural optimists, is what I'm
optimism
trying to say.
Optimism is for fools.
Okay, well, there we go. Optimism, so I was going to ask,
the secret of happiness is pessimism.
Because if I was going to say, if someone's going to ask me what gives me hope, because I think these are, from my own perspective, very politically bleak times, but what gives me hope, I always think, are younger people who I think have suffered tremendously over the last 15 years. Austerity has disproportionately affected them. The pandemic, we don't agree with the response, but they suffered the terrible consequences because they formed a cordon sanitaire amongst the elderly population. They give me hope because politically, I think they're the most progressive generation we've ever had. That gives me hope. What gives you hope?
Oh, well, my hopes are religious. I have no material.
So the next life.
Political hopes. Well, for eternity. There is, I mean, for instance, you and I both desire, absolutely certain, desire justice very, very strongly. We have it within us as an almost burning, fiery furnace.
Yeah, something
so,
yeah.
Absolutely desire. Yeah. And also, both of us know that in this life we will not see justice.
I don't give up on that, actually, but fine.
It won't happen.
I disagree.
But so, therefore, the only place in which I can see the possibility of justice is eternity. So that's what I stick to.
History turns on a sixpence. Things can change very, very quickly if you look throughout history. Very dramatically.
Yes, they
often
can.
The
yes,
worst.
As you say.
On that optimistic note, Peter, it's been a pleasure as ever.
Thank you for listening, everyone. I hope you found that educational, interesting, engaging, and all sorts of other things. Do support us on patreon.com/ownjones84. You keep doing the podcast and the channel with our incredible team's work, or use the support function in the description. And do subscribe and leave us a review, please. Some stars, any of those things. But otherwise, lots of love. Hope you're well. Speak to you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.